Welcome to this episode of Kennedy's new Medical Law Matters podcast, where we dive into some of the most important conversations around healthcare and medical law. My name is Robert Tobin. I'm the head of medical law at Kennedy's. And today we're going to be exploring a crucial topic, advanced care planning, the process of telling a future team of carers how you'd want to and perhaps wouldn't want to be cared for, helping them to know what's in your best interests. This is something very close to my heart, having watched my dad go through this very difficult process, but be guided through it expertly by his hospice carers. So today, I've got the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Zoe Fritz, who's a consultant at Addenbrooke's Hospital, Cambridge University Hospital, and an expert in applied clinical ethics. In this first part, Dr. Fritz explains the basics of advanced care planning, its importance, and how it helps both patients and healthcare professionals make difficult decisions, but better decisions about the future. Whether you're a healthcare provider, a caregiver, or just someone thinking about your own healthcare preferences, this episode is for you. But before we jump in, make sure you subscribe to our newsletter for updates on upcoming episodes and special content. You can find all the links in the show notes. And don't forget to follow us on your favorite podcast platform, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening today, so you never miss an episode. Now, before we get started, Zoe, perhaps you could quickly introduce yourself.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me. So my name is, as you said, Zoe Fritz. I am a consultant at Addenbrooke's Hospital in acute medicine, and I do research in applied clinical ethics. I'm part of the Healthcare Improvement Studies Institute at the University of Cambridge. And my general research is looking at how patients and doctors interact, how we do things, and looking at where those might cause ethical discomfort or autonomy disrespecting practice, trying to come up with new ideas on how to deal with that and then test them out, very much involving patients, doctors, nurses, and anyone else who might be involved to try and make healthcare delivery and healthcare interaction more equitable and more ethical.
Thank you. And it's really great that you've joined us today. So thank you from me. I mean, I should say we know each other, we work with each other, and we have done for quite a few years now, I think. We sit on the Cambridge University Hospital's Clinical Ethics Advisory Group, CEAG for short. And so we see some of these issues coming up. Perhaps we can start with the basics. So what do we mean by advanced care planning?
Well, you say that's the basics, but obviously it's complicated because people interpret different things by it. So in my mind, advanced care planning is a huge umbrella term for anything that involves a patient or those close to them thinking about what treatments or health outcomes they might want in the future. And the advanced care planning huge umbrella would include the treatments and health outcomes they might want in the future when they have capacity, when they can make decisions for themselves. So it's almost like an exercise in thinking about what they might want in the future, so at that point, they can be better prepared. But it also importantly includes thinking about what they might want in the future in an event where they didn't have capacity. So if they were to become very much sicker and weren't able to communicate what treatments they would want or what health outcomes they value, health outcomes they fear, then advanced care planning is a way of thinking about communicating and recording those thoughts and wishes so that other family members and healthcare professionals can respect those wishes.
Thank you, very succinctly put. I suppose we should break it down into why we are so keen for patients or future patients, people who aren't sick or they have no anticipation of being a patient in the future, why it's important from a patient perspective to document what they want done for them and what they don't want done for them in the future, but also from a medical perspective, why that's useful. And I mean, I can cover, if you like, the legal perspective. So do you want to, you can cover the patient's perspective, perhaps, and the medical perspective.
Yeah, and I think you're right to divide those in two, although I think they're symbiotic. So I think basically we're in a situation where in the last 150 years, we have developed all kinds of medical treatments that mean that the vast majority of times patients come into contact with doctors, they're going to come in, get hopefully a diagnosis and certainly get treated and get better. So we have a relationship with medicine, which is that it can fix us. If you have a pneumonia, you get antibiotics and you get better. Often if you have a cancer, fortunately now, you can have it picked up, you can have an operation, you can have chemotherapy, and you can at least go into remission. That wasn't the case even 50 years ago. There were all kinds of things, heart attacks, thrombolysis. So we've gotten to the habit of expecting treatments to get us better. And as doctors, we've gotten the habit of thinking that we can fix people. And obviously, as Ardy Lang said, life is a sexually transmitted condition and the mortality is 100%. So we all die and we all need to recognize that. And we are less good at talking about it, I think, as a society, as it has become something that we perceive as being able to be put off or fixed. And the problem is that if we don't talk about it or think about it, then the expectation from a patient point of view and the expectation from a medical point of view is that we will keep on doing treatments in order to save someone's life. And some of those treatments are quite burdensome. And sometimes we don't stop and ask whether they are something that a patient would want. So if someone hasn't considered an advanced care plan or a future care plan, as it's called in Scotland and Northern Ireland and in various other parts of the world, if someone hasn't considered or documented it, the assumption is we're going to keep going. We're going to keep giving treatments. And that might include taking someone to intensive care, putting them on a ventilator. It might include extensive chemotherapeutic regimes. It might include attempting to restart someone's heart if it stops. Now, all of those things can be of benefit to patients. I'm not suggesting that we stop doing these extreme life-saving measures by any stretch of the imagination. But I am saying I think we should think about what those mean for the patient and that they are actually what the patient wants. And if we don't ask, we don't find out. Now, I obviously, as I said at the beginning, I work in this field. So I work clinically, I see patients regularly, and then I do research. And I'm probably on the extreme end of asking patients about what they want. So anybody who comes in under my care, even if it was someone who is completely able-bodied and well and independent and I had no concerns. I mean, obviously they're not completely well because they've come into hospital, but if they've come in acutely sick with something, I will still say to them, there are all kinds of treatments we can give you in hospital. I assume you would want to be considered for all of them, including, for example, restarting your heart, blood transfusion, etc. And if you say it like that, actually sometimes patients will tell me what they, you know, for example, we could discover that someone was a Jehovah's Witness that hadn't been documented clearly. But my theory is if you ask that question, you're just destigmatizing the idea that actually it's not assumed that you're always going to get that kind of treatment. So me asking that simple question is a very basic form of advanced care planning. It's me just checking that you want the things that we're going to give you. But as soon as someone has a more complex situation, and perhaps they've been in hospital before, perhaps they're struggling with various aspects. So perhaps someone has a lung condition, they've found themselves getting more and more breathless, being able to walk less and less, and as a result, they're enjoying their life less. Now, again, it's important to say, for some people, that's fine. Being able to walk not so far or being a bit breathless. I had one patient who I always remember saying to me, so long as I can feel the sun on my face and listen to music, I'm happy. And it was really important to understand what it was that was important to her, because then we could continue to give her treatments that were going to make sure that she could continue to feel the sun on her face and listen to some music. But there are other patients for whom, for example, getting much more breathless and not being able to walk, they go, do you know what? I'm kind of reaching the end of what I'm enjoying in life. And if a treatment was going to result in a condition where I was much more breathless and I was housebound, actually, I would rather go quickly. I don't want a lingering death. So that's a less succinct answer than the last one. But the point is that it's that advanced care planning or future care planning is this huge umbrella to make sure that we have had people, and where they lack capacity, their relatives, think about what is most important to that patient so we don't make assumptions and we don't give patients treatments that they wouldn't want. And actually the reverse is true too, that we don't withhold treatments that they might benefit from.
And I suppose we should say that advanced care planning doesn't necessarily just cover life and death situations. It could be any treatment. I think one thing that's really striking is what you say is the comparison between a consent discussion. So let's say a doctor has in front of them a patient and they're discussing surgery that the patient needs. And the patient in this scenario has full capacity, mental capacity. So they understand what's being discussed with them. They can use and weigh the information and communicate their decision about whether or not they want that surgery back to the doctor. And it's all around patient autonomy. And as we know, thankfully, the medical world has moved away from the sort of very paternalistic approach to medicine where doctor tells you need this treatment and you just have this treatment. Or sometimes they used to not even tell you that you need this treatment and just provide that treatment. Now it's very much patient focused and it's all around the autonomy of the patient. And I suppose, am I right that advanced care planning is almost anticipating that conversation in the future, when at a time when the patient, the person, has the mental capacity to understand and communicate their wishes and feelings and values, but and also anticipating that there'll be a time when they won't have that capacity. And so being able to communicate it now rather than in the future.
I would add two things to that. One is that I think advanced care planning is useful even when someone still has capacity, because although they can obviously change their mind, it just means they've thought through things before and it's not such a shock to think through it at that point. So I think it's actually just a useful preparatory exercise for both the patient and for the doctor. And I know we're going to get onto it later, but I think establishing that shared understanding between the patient and doctor of the kind of things that they might have to think about, and perhaps it will be a kind of a lever for considering what the prognosis is and what to expect, which I think is something we just don't talk about enough in chronic conditions. You know, what are the kind of things that could happen in the future? How should I be prepared for those? What kind of things might I need to think about and might I need to make decisions about? How can I fill my family in on this? We're a little bit head in the sand on that, I think. And I think doing some advanced care planning can help facilitate that conversation. And the other bit I left out in my answer earlier, because we were talking about patients and doctors, but I just wanted to bring in the relatives. And it links back to the doctors as well. But if you've had an advanced care planning discussion with a patient, it really helps protect both the doctor and the relatives from being in the morally uncomfortable situation of feeling like they have to make a decision on someone's behalf and having to guess what it is that person would want. So I've had many conversations with relatives before advanced care planning was prevalent and since then. And I can tell you that when advanced care planning hasn't happened in the past, and in fact, there have been obviously it's not universal, as again, we'll talk about. So there continue to be cases where people haven't had a conversation with a patient. And then as a doctor, you're having a conversation with a relative saying, well, what do you think they would have wanted? And there are quite a few studies that come from the States that show that relatives are very unwilling to say patients wouldn't want treatment because they don't want to be perceived as giving up on the patient. Obviously, there's often complicated family dynamics, perhaps, you know, there's guilt, there's all kinds of things that go on. And so for a family member to say, I wouldn't want that treatment is much, much harder than for an individual to say, I wouldn't want that treatment. And actually the reverse is true too, right? So sometimes family members then feel that they're torturing a patient by saying that they would want a treatment and they're not sure and it causes conflict. So any individual who does advanced care planning is doing their family a huge favor because it's taking that emotional burden away from them in the future. And it's much, much easier for the clinicians to not get into conflict with relatives about trying to guess what it is that would have been best for this patient.
Let's go back. We'll go back to the legal beginnings just for people who are listening who perhaps aren't aware of this. You know, we talked about consent and patient autonomy. In a situation, a patient lacks capacity, mental capacity to make a particular healthcare decision, the relevant healthcare decision that we're focused on or you're focused on as a clinician. The law in this country is that, in England and Wales, is that you have to, or the clinician has to treat that patient in their best interests. And that's a very difficult term, best interests, because it's very individualized. And there is no one shape which fits all for best interest. So, and this is why it's so important. And when I introduced the question around the medical perspective and the patient perspective, I suppose this is the legal perspective. So when I'm called up by, let's say, an NHS trust because there's a patient in ICU who's lacking capacity, perhaps they're unconscious, and the clinicians have a treatment in mind which is in their best interest, or perhaps that treatment is to give no active treatment and perhaps to go with palliative treatment only. The question that I would be asking, and of course you would be asking, is, well, what is the patient's best interest? So what do they want? And you have to put yourself in the patient's shoes. And that's where you're talking, Zoe, about the relatives, and because they obviously know the patient much better than you do, because as a clinician, chances are you've never met this patient before in your life, and it may well be the first time you meet them, they're unconscious. And that's even more so for me.
And I was going to say, I mean, the danger of a clinician making a best interest decision on behalf of a patient who they don't know is that they are projecting what they think is most important. And we all have our own ideas of what we think is most important. We all have our own ideas of what constitutes, for example, a good quality of life or a reasonable risk to take in a treatment. You know, if this treatment has a risk of something really severe happening, but it's a small risk, we all have different kind of risk attitudes. So making that judgment for someone else, I mean, that is part of what a clinician has to do. But normally we engage in that decision-making with a patient when they've lost capacity and they don't have an LPA, then we're making a best interest decision. I guess you might want to talk about LPAs as well.
Yeah, just to finish that point off. So if you're faced with a patient lacking capacity and you don't know them, you can and you should speak to the relatives to find out what they believe would be in the patient's best interest. But I think what we're saying is that wouldn't it be amazing if the patient had already told you what was in their best interests and they told you in a document that they'd written, perhaps rewritten and rewritten and rewritten, because it's a very dynamic process, but over a number of months, weeks or days, or even years, I suppose, that you can look at to really get a sense of who this patient is.
Yes. And you're right that, you know, an advanced care planning or future care planning document could be something that is long and lovingly written over a long period. But I would also say, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. And any documentation of a general indication of what a patient values is much better than nothing. And so I think there is a danger that if we say, oh, this is something that needs to be really carefully thought through and everybody needs to be involved, it's just going to be put off. And actually, other research we've done has shown that in general, patients would rather start a conversation with someone than wait for the best possible opportunity. So sometimes clinicians are really nervous about starting this conversation, perhaps because they don't know the patient well enough or they don't know the condition well enough. Both very good reasons to be nervous. And clearly these conversations need to be had well and carefully. But starting a conversation, recognizing this is something that needs to be done, saying we need to think about the future, we need to think about what treatments you would or wouldn't benefit from, what outcomes you value, what outcomes you fear, is something that we all should be better at. And when I say we all, I mean clinicians all and patients all. And I think, you know, I'm delighted to be invited to do this podcast, but I think we need to be engaging the public more in thinking about how we have these conversations as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the ideas of this podcast, so hopefully members of the public will listen and take note. So you mentioned LPAs, and I'll just explain what LPAs are to the listeners. So an LPA is a lasting power of attorney. And this is a legal document that a patient, when they have capacity, creates, and it's effectively them giving the permission or giving the authority to someone else, or it could be a few people, to make decisions on their behalf in the future at a time when they lose capacity. And they might be around property and affairs, or in the context that we're talking about, it could be health and welfare decisions. And when we're talking about the discussions that you'd have with the relatives, if someone has an LPA in place, it's that person that you're talking about, the attorney, is the decision maker. And again, with advanced care planning, presumably the advanced care plan document is an incredibly powerful, useful guide to that decision maker, the relative or the loved one, whoever it is who's been given that LPA. And the other legal document or power that I suppose we should distinguish here is advanced decisions to refuse treatment, ADRTs, sometimes called advanced directives or advanced decisions, and advanced care planning. And from a legal perspective, and Zoe, you can enhance this on from a medical perspective, but from a legal perspective, an ADRT, an advanced decision to refuse treatment, is a binding document. So this is something that a patient writes, again, at a time when they have capacity. And if it's around a decision around life or death, it has to be in writing and it has to be witnessed and it has to have a document. So in that document, a statement that says they understand that the consequence of this decision they're making is that they might die. And they are refusing, and refusing is the very important word here, they are refusing treatment in the future. And if that is a valid document and the clinician is provided it, they cannot override what the patient says on that document. So again, it's a very important future plan. Whereas an advanced care plan doesn't necessarily include refusals. It might do. It might just have a long list of wishes, values, and feelings to help guide clinicians about best interests. Do you have anything more you want to sort of elaborate on that, Zoe, in terms of the distinctions?
Yeah, so I guess I think of it all as being part of advanced care planning or future care planning. All of, like, there are lots of different ways that you can think about how you're going to cope in a situation in the future where you aren't able to make decisions for yourself, or as I say, do this forward planning. And I would agree that an ADRT, advanced decision to refuse treatment, is obviously I agree. It's legally binding, it's different, and it's very specific. But I feel like it comes under the whole umbrella of thinking about advanced care planning. So when we talk about it as a verb, that whole process might include all kinds of things. It might include, or future care planning, as I keep, I quite like this future care planning that they're talking about in, so they've changed the terminology in Scotland and Northern Ireland, and they talk about future care planning, which I think is quite helpful because we are talking about the future, but something that we may or may not need, but it's just anticipating the future and what your needs might be. And so the ADRT might be a very specific part of that. You might have all kinds of, I guess, social things that you might be doing. And then having a medical advanced care plan, a more specific set of documents about what you would want in terms of your, you know, you could actually even consider your will part of future care planning, right? There's all kinds of stuff that you could think about within that group. We see ADRTs rarely. And the problem with ADRTs is that they're very specific for a treatment that wouldn't be wanted. And as you say, to give that treatment would be considered assault. Although I'm not sure of that many cases where doctors have actually been pursued for doing a treatment in conflict with an ADRT. You can tell me about that. But from a doctor's point of view, they're a bit challenging because, for example, if someone has an ADRT saying they don't want to have resuscitation, there are situations where resuscitation, someone's heart stopping might be from a very reversible cause, which wasn't what they anticipated when they wrote that ADRT. When they wrote the ADRT, they said they didn't want CPR because they imagined the heart stopping as the final part of the dying process. But what if the heart stops because they're choking? Or what if the heart stops because they're having an operation and the anesthetic's gone wrong? Then in theory, the ADRT is a legally binding document that means the doctor cannot attempt to restart their heart. And so it doesn't give any wriggle room. Whereas if you write an advanced care plan, and I do have one that's my kind of favorite way of doing this, which we can talk about in a second, then you can write about what health outcomes you value and what health outcomes you fear. And you can say in general, I wouldn't want X or Y, but that's a recommendation. And ultimately at the time of you being sick and not having capacity, the clinician has the information about what it is you're trying to achieve, but they still have the discretion about which treatments to give or not give in order to get you where you want to be and not get you where you don't want to be. So I have to say, personally, I prefer a really good advanced care plan to an ADRT.
It's interesting you say that because, I mean, it puts more pressure, does it not, or more decision-making on the clinician, an advanced care plan, as opposed to an ADRT?
My own personal experience is I've seen very, very few ADRTs. So I think people rarely write them. And when I have seen them, they can be about very specific things. So some people have real fears of treatments that they don't want. So, and that's absolutely fine to make sure that you don't want to have certain things. But as I say, I think it's very hard to predict all of the different possible health situations you'll be in, all of the different possible treatments that may or may not be of benefit to you. And so being really clear about what it is you want to achieve in terms of health outcomes, yes, it does leave more clinical decision making to the doctor, but that's what we're trained to do. So if we know what it is, that the tricky bit for a doctor is working out what would this patient want. So if the patient can write down what it is they want from life, from the end of life, from so on, then we're quite good with that clinical discretion of trying to get them there. That's what we're good at.
Yeah. I mean, for what it's worth, I agree with you about ADRTs. I mean, I haven't seen many of them, but I suppose what I see is the warped perspective, because the ones I see are the ones that are controversial. And in fact, I have dealt with a case quite a while ago involving a patient who had motor neuron disease. And he, because he had a condition that he knew was degenerative, he did write an advanced care plan and an ADRT, and he did actually say in this document that if he chokes, he doesn't want to be given antibiotics if he gets an aspiration pneumonia. But that was in the context of his motor neuron disease progressing. But as it turned out, he happened to be in hospital for something else at the time, and he did slightly choke on a piece of food, but the doctors don't think that was because of his motor neuron disease. He just, like we all do, he choked, and there was a big confusion at the time about whether or not he ought to be given antibiotics. For me, I agree that they're very ambiguous. You see them, ADRTs, in, you mentioned Jehovah's Witnesses before, you see them with Jehovah's Witnesses because they very much anticipate a circumstance. If they do need a blood transfusion, they absolutely don't want to be given
Exactly. So that's an example blood. Of where there's a particular treatment or intervention that isn't wanted, and absolutely fair enough. And the other situation, I think, is where trust has been lost. So actually, we've had a couple of cases in the clinical ethics advisory group where patients haven't felt that doctors were acting in their best interest, and they haven't trusted the doctor for that clinical discretion that I'm talking about. And so they are wanting, in anticipation, to say, I don't want to lose autonomy. In a situation where I have lost capacity, I want to know that my wishes are absolutely going to be respected, and I don't want you to have any discretion. And again, you know, of course that's fair, and it's absolutely right that we have a mechanism for people doing that. I just think it leaves no wriggle room for those gray cases where maybe what was anticipated isn't what's happened, and we could fix someone and get them back to a quality of life that they would want, but we don't because they were anticipating something different. But if that's going to make the person feel better about the fact that they've maintained autonomy all the way through, then of course that is worth valuing. And I'm absolutely not saying we should get rid of ADRTs. And I totally see their value. I'm just expressing my personal points.
Yeah, no, and I agree with you for what it's worth. And I think, you know, on a personal perspective, I would much prefer, and in fact do have, an LPA in place, because the LPA, if you have someone or some people who you trust and you know that they know you well and will make decisions on your behalf in your best interests because they know you much better than the future doctor who's never met you, then I think that's the mechanism to have your decisions made, ideally, with an advanced care plan to guide them as well, and et cetera, et cetera. But there are, as you say, there are certain circumstances where an ADRT might be beneficial.
So it's just, this is not an ADRT, but this is a patient who thought that they didn't want any treatment. This is just a fun illustrative example, one I give in my lectures. So I had an elderly lady who was independent, who came in with a series of things that had gone wrong. So she'd got a pneumonia. The pneumonia had put her into atrial fibrillation, which is a fast irregular heart rate. And the heart rate had been going so fast, she'd had a heart attack. So she'd gone from being really quite well to being extremely sick. But each one of those three things is treatable. So you can give antibiotics for the pneumonia, you can give drugs to slow the heart rate down, and you can give some drugs to protect the heart. And I was pretty confident she was going to get back to her independent state. But at that moment in hospital, she really felt like she was about to die. And she was in her 80s, and she was just like, I don't want any blood tests. So the junior doctor came to see me and said, she's refusing any blood tests. She doesn't want any more treatment. She wants to be allowed to die. Does she understand that she might well not die from this? And she said, oh, well, I've tried to tell her. So I went to see her with an entourage. Okay. So old school, because I was seeing someone else, another doctor had come. So I had like four people with me. And I went in and sat by her bed, and I crouched on the floor, and I explained what I've just explained to you about the pneumonia and the atrial fibrillation and the heart attack. And I said, look, all of these things I think are treatable. I think we have a good chance of getting you back home in about a week. I think you'll be in hospital for a week, but I really think we have a good chance of getting you back home and independent. I don't think you're going to die from this. And I think, you know, I need to take the blood tests in order to be able to manage all these treatments properly. And I need you to, you know, if you're happy for us to do that, I said, I promise we won't do anything extreme. We won't try and restart your heart if it stops. We won't take you to intensive care. I think we can manage you on the ward. I think we can give you all these treatments. I think we'll get you better. Is that all right? She went, oh, okay, but I'm just about ready for my coffin. And I said, no, I really don't think you are ready for your coffin. I really think you're going to survive this. And she went, coffee. I'm ready for a coffee. Anyway, that was an example of where she did a 180 degree turn in the course of honestly a 5-minute conversation, where she thought she wanted no more treatments because she had understood that she was going to die from this, and therefore she didn't want anything. She wanted to just be allowed to go quickly. And so I'm just saying, I think people, our job as doctors is also to make sure that there's this shared understanding of what's going on and what the prognosis is.
So that wraps up part one of my discussion with Zoe on advanced care planning. I hope you found this segment insightful as we begin to explore the basics of how these conversations can empower both patients and their loved ones. Stay tuned for the next episode, where we'll dive deeper into the respect process and real-world case studies. If you haven't yet, please do subscribe to our podcast on platforms like Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to sign up to our newsletter to get the latest updates and exclusive content straight to your inbox. Thanks for listening, and catch you in the next episode.